is Deanna Spingola. It is Saturday, January 26, 2013, and this is one of my special interviews. We have no commercials, no censorship, no calls, and no music. It is just education and information. It is bare bones broadcasting. My guest today is Veronica Clark. Her website is veronicaclark1.wordpress.com. Now, may I also say that your other website is nspowerwolf.wordpress.com?
Yeah, I'm not 100% behind that, but yes, I definitely contribute to it, and I'm a writer on there. So,
okay,
absolutely.
Great. And I know that your YouTube channel went down, and I don't have your new one in front of me.
But I don't know the specific address. It's on Daily Motion. Yeah, it's linked. So,
So
one can just click that video page thing. But it's on Daily Motion and it's True Image Group.
Okay.
True_image_group.
All righty.
A whole bunch of those videos got reported. So there's only one up right now.
My goodness.
Yeah, someone's following. That's fine.
My goodness.
I have the radio shows and they can't stop those, so that's good. I know. And I wanted to take a little break from Hitler, but then this Condit thing just came back up.
Indeed.
So, you know, we can't leave that untouched, huh?
That's certainly true.
Right.
I cannot believe that he hasn't learned anything since the last time that he debated that issue about his the final solution of Adolf Hitler.
Right.
And even the name is ridiculous. It reminds people of the so-called Nazis' final solution to the Jewish problem. So
yeah, and he doesn't even know who I am. So that's probably a good thing, though. I really don't want to get involved. Honestly, I'd rather be on the sidelines and unknown.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, so let me just begin, and this is going to seem off topic, but it will tie in with what we're going to go over. Which is basically, the gist of it is the complexity of World War II, the financing of it, the waging of it, etc. Like Jim Condit, I think too many people are trying to simplify it. And that makes it a nice, easy thesis for people to follow. Like, if we can only blame it on the Zionists, if we can only blame it on the British, etc., etc. Things are far more complicated than that. And I think even with Obama today, a lot of people want to attack and demonize him, but we must hand it to him that he has not buckled to Israel yet. Why? I mean, if he's so Jewish controlled, as we believe, as many people in the truth movement believe, then why hasn't he buckled yet? What is he holding out for? These are questions we do need to ask ourselves. And I am also seeing, I do hope, that this is sincere, but he is going to come down, allegedly, as he says, on those companies that are trying to circumvent Obamacare. Now, I was previously without medical insurance until very recently, and I personally know what it's like to not have health care. And so I'm far more sympathetic with Obamacare than perhaps a wealthy American. And I think that every American should be covered. So when I see employers trying to circumvent that by cutting the actual job description to be only part-time, it really, that is the ultimate irk to me. And supposedly he's going to make that impossible. Now that would be a positive development, and that would be something that Hitler very much would have done. And so again, we can't simplify things so much so that we go, oh, he is totally controlled, or he has no, you know, will or anything of his own, because that's kind of what Condit says about Hitler. Well, maybe he did have a little bit of a will of his own, but then again, he, you know, he ended up falling right into the trap. That seems to be where he's at now, but before he was pretty much, Hitler had Jewish handlers.
Right. So he has changed, and he certainly has changed, I believe, in his opinion about a couple of other factors.
Oh, he has definitely moved a little bit over, because when he, what I have in the Union Jackal is his initial argument, and he had sent that out as an email, and I think Hans Kampa had sent it to me and responded to it, and he was just flipped out about it. He's like, what is this? You know, we have to address this. So just... so people know, the whole Jim Condit debate is in the Union Jackal. It has a whole chapter dedicated to it, and every single point is dealt with. And the Dunkirk issue, as well as Stalin's aggression and, of course, his own will, is addressed in pretty good detail in the introduction to the Hyenas of High Finance. And that's an essay that Wilfried Hayek, Hans Krampe, I myself, and Luis Munoz worked on together for, oh, that essay started in, I believe, 2007. So, and then we published the book in 2011. So that's something that had been built up for a very long time, that introduction. So people should read that as well, because it's all in there, the whole Dunkirk thing. And again, that is an issue that was very complicated, that is, people are trying to simplify it. Oh, well, Hitler must have been a British agent if he let that happen, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
Not quite. But right. Let's start with medieval warfare. And
okay.
I don't know if I'm saying this right. I'm just going to make this real brief. I had to intensively study medieval warfare, and it was mostly about strategy and tactics and whatnot. But this very important section of this one reading we did is about how Europeans famined and genocided their own in the medieval period. And it's called a chevauchée. Now, I don't know if that's 100% correct pronunciation because it's French, but it comes from chevalerie. That's the term that it's derived from, which is knighthood or deeds of horsemanship and arms. Now, this is supposed to be the era of chivalry where, you know, knights spared other knights, and instead of death or slavery, as we might have expected in the 7th century European warfare, they were only ransomed. So they had to pay some plunder fee, basically. But they were allowed to live. Very honorable, etc. However, this code only governed the relationships between knights. So relatively few were killed when a knight fought a knight. But the non-knights, or quote-unquote barbarians, and that's where this comes from, and this would be like the common infantry, or the Welsh, Irish, and pagan Slavs, were not covered by this code. And, of course, knights who didn't observe it dealing with other knights were unpopular, but if you slaughtered at will these barbarians, it was fine. It was fair game. No one thought anything of it. But basically, here's the gist of this guy's argument, and it's very interesting and very pertinent. So he says, outside this group of the chivalric code, chivalry did little to limit the brutality of war. The plundering raid, or chevauchée, the normal practice of chivalric warfare, was aimed at the civilian population in order to put pressure on their rulers, much as indiscriminate area bombing was in the Second World War. And what I found very interesting about this method of warfare is that it was in particular the French and the British that did it, just as the Anglo-Saxons were the predominant horror show of World War II. And I think that this is an inherent thing of the French and the British in particular. And this is why they have done so much to perpetuate Jewish power, to basically do the Jews' will. The Jews are the brain, and the Anglo-Saxon is the body, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this shows that this penchant was already there well before Jews were involved. So we cannot just go, well, because the Jews instigated this, or because they played a role in this, that made us do this. That's like a drug user blaming the drug dealer for his or her drug addiction. Partially, yes, the drug dealer's partially responsible. If they weren't supplied, there would be no users. But doesn't the user need to assume responsibility for him or herself?
Yeah, this is
the problem we're running into. And so this is an instance where, you know, Condit's argument and many others in the truth movement are trying to blame everything on the Jews. Well, aren't the British and even the Germans to an extent, The Soviets, the French, etc., everybody who participated, have they no will of their own? Did they not enact famine and indiscriminate bombing of their own free will? No Rothschild member held a gun to Churchill's head and said, "You will area bomb."
Right.
You know? So we need to be a little bit careful trying to pin everything on them. Yes, they are responsible for the financing. Yes, many Jews instigated and put forth that propaganda. But a similar instance occurred with the slave trade. The Jews oftentimes, in fact, I think almost exclusively owned the ships of the slave trade, and they were oftentimes the predominant owners of African slaves in colonial slave-holding America. However, their role does not exonerate those non-Jewish white peoples that participated in that slave trade and committed horrific acts that are well detailed in Douglas Blackman's Slavery by Another Name. They're not exonerated of their guilt in that trade. So again, we see the truth movement trying to pin, I think Michael Hoffman sort of does this, trying to pin it on the Jews in an effort to exonerate the white race, but does it entirely.
Right.
Who are we going to blame for these chevauchées? Let me just go a little bit further with these. It is often said that the chevauchée was an invention of the English in Scotland and France in the 14th century. The French term, literally meaning, quote, to be on horseback, end quote, appears in the late 12th century to describe a plundering expedition into enemy territory, and the long-distance mounted raid is found in Frankish, English, and British Welsh warfare at least as early as the 7th century. So here we have the early 7th century, and the English, French, and British, which were the Welsh back in that time, committing famine, plundering raids against innocent civilians. That was them doing that of their own accord. It really didn't matter who was financing it. Of course, they had to have someone paying them, right? But they did these plundering raids basically to pay themselves. So it was a different kind of financing, but the warfare was no less horrific and civilians were no less targeted. It's just that aircraft made the civilian targeting much, much easier and far more horrendous. But even Caesar advocated genocide and absolute plundering, scorched earth warfare against the civilians that he conquered. In particular, there was one treatise he wrote about the Gauls. And he said, yes, men, women, children, I don't care. Slaughter them all, burn everything, destroy their fields. That's how we win. So are we going to blame Caesar's financiers for that behavior? That's kind of a problem there. But here's basically what they did. Despite the fact that it, oh, wait, let me start further ahead here. According to King Henry V, and he's 1413 to 1422, quote, "War without fire is like sausages without mustard," end quote. Here's an English king saying this. Why that was so is made specific in the 13th century history of William the Marshal, quote, "For when the poor can no longer reap the harvest from their fields, then they can no longer pay their rents, and this in turn impoverishes their lords," end quote. So see, instead of going after the lords, they went after the peasants and killed them and burned their fields and starved them into submission. That was how they got to the lords. It's the same thing today. We see the Taliban, for example, in its effort to resist this incredible Anglo-Saxon American power that they could never stand up to in conventional style, targeting innocent people in a market square to get at the Americans, because when people like you and me see the atrocities and the bombings occurring and civilian death and suffering, we want an end to the war. So that's how they win. They win by proxy. And of course, we're in a proxy war against Iran. it is far easier to encircle and strangle Iran into death and maybe send in a CIA faction to overthrow the government when it's at its weakest point and the Iranian people can be incited and then we enact our will once it's toppled, than to actually invade the country in a conventional style, which is becoming increasingly expensive as well because of aircraft and bombs. So it's always easier to go by proxy, and we always see this everywhere. That was the way the IRA waged its war against the British government. What did they do? They went and bombed average people going to work on subway trams. So this is not, it's nothing new. And of course, the British did this against the German government. They wanted to topple the NSDAP. How do you do that? The most effective manner, at least back in that day, you bomb the heck out of the civilians. You destroy the infrastructure so that Hitler can't send troops to the front because there's no rails left. And of course, that entails the whole Holocaust fallout. You know, and this has always been, we've always had these kind of famine style Holocausts. And this, you know, back even back in the chivalric days. And then just going on, despite the fact that it meant poor men suffered, pillaging was not considered dishonorable, nor was this destruction mindless. The soldiers' love of burning. To Vigeshius, quote, "The main and principal point in war is to secure plenty of provisions for oneself, in other words, booty, and to destroy the enemy by famine. Famine is the is more terrible than the sword," end quote. So here we have soldiers plundering, giving them an incentive to participate in war and make them wealthy. And of course, the civilian population is either enslaved or destroyed through famine. And rape and murder were also very common. And it's not in this particular selection that I had to study for my course in military history, but it's another one. And I was very surprised to learn that the Catholic Church at that time, and this probably would have been a little bit later, but this whole chevauchée thing was becoming an enormous problem for European, you know, European people generally. Women and children were raped and murdered. Churches that would gather up these innocent civilians and try to protect them from the plundering European armies that were ravaging these countrysides, these mercenaries from Sweden, Switzerland, etc., the pikemen is what they were called because they fought with pikes, they would be literally burned out of these churches, or they'd break the walls, you know, they'd break the doors in and come in, murder the priests, and rape and pillage everybody inside. So this is a European thing that happened quite often. It was such a problem that the church decided, hey, we'll send them on these anti-Muslim crusades to get them out of Europe. Better them than us. And that is that's the real reason for the crusades. It was not really a holy war at all. It was the church trying to mitigate the damage and get these plundering armies out of Europe.
Amazing.
Very amazing. I was stunned to learn that. And of course, the propaganda to sell these men on that war was the holy aspect. But this undercuts those people that say, oh, if we could only get religion out of there, everything would be fine. No, it wouldn't. They'd come up with some other thing to fight for.
Right.
So that out of the way, I just think it's important that people see that warfare and plunder and famine and European upon European fratricide was there long before the Jews ever played a direct role in financing anything or even, you know, pushing their propaganda. The Jews merely jumped into what was already kind of there, the divisions, the rivalries, etc., the power struggle between the Anglo-Saxon race and the German race, the continent and the island. And of course, Wilfried Hank's essay in The Union Jackal really gets into that, and he does a beautiful treatment of that problem. The Jews merely got in there and took advantage and exploited for their own ends that rivalry. And that's really what World War II was. And just because the Zionists came out on top and Germany was destroyed and Britain lost her empire does not mean that was ever the intent. It just worked out that way. And of course, the Jews said, hey, we can get something out of this fratricide. We can not only encourage it, finance at least the British side, but we can get something out of this if we cleverly exploit it. And of course, the NSDAP was good at its own exploitation of events. For example, Kristallnacht. Now, Kristallnacht is very similar to the Sandy Hook massacre. And I think people are simplifying that too much, too. I definitely agree there's something strange about it, but I don't want to say 100% conspiracy there and that the U.S. government is involved, etc., because in the case of Kristallnacht, it very much looked like, oh, because Jews had their guns taken away and couldn't even get ammunition in 1938 after Kristallnacht, that must mean that the NSDAP enacted Kristallnacht to do just that. No, the NSDAP simply exploited a situation that was not of their making. And Ingrid Veckert has done an incredible treatment of that. And of course, her main rival is David Irving, who contends that Goebbels did indeed instigate Kristallnacht and supposedly admitted so in his diaries. Now, we've already gone over that in depth. And what you'll find is that he does not, in the one diary entry where he says, yeah, I've done stupid things like back in such and such time, we cannot say for sure. That is not specifically referring to Kristallnacht in that particular diary entry, so we cannot simply assume. Secondly, Irving cites the Moscow glass plate diary copies. He would not show those to Ingrid Veckert. She doesn't understand why. What is the problem with showing me that so I can see if my thesis is valid or not? He wouldn't show them to her. So he's the only one that's seen them, and therefore, can we trust that? And of course, I ordered the Goebbels diaries, and those entries are missing. The specific ones for 1938 are not in his diaries. And that's directly from the IFZ in Germany. Why were they left out? I would assume that they exonerate Goebbels, and that's why they were left out, because you don't want people knowing, oh, hey, wait a minute, Goebbels didn't order this. There's no evidence there from the 1938 entries. It makes more sense to me that they would keep that out, and yeah, Moscow, you have those copies. There's other strange things about those Moscow copies, and we've gone over those before, too, where certain words are not, they weren't even in general use in
Germany.
Right.
Yes, I remember.
Yeah. So there's really no need to rehash that. But again, we need to be careful simplifying.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that goes to the Hitler gun control debate. Or I guess we can start with that myth.
Okay. We covered it briefly in a program that I did just about a week ago. But I don't think that we covered it in total. And I think there were still some unanswered questions that some of the listeners had.
Okay. I would put it this way. The NSDAP did have gun control because the Weimar government had those laws on the books. They did have gun control laws, which were then carried over to the NSDAP, and they were not modified until later. Now, Hitler did make those more lenient for German citizens, but if one was Jewish, gypsy, or a vagabond, one could not possess a gun, one could not purchase a gun, and one, I believe, couldn't even purchase ammo. It was to the point where the Jews could not even get ammunition. Now, that doesn't mean that every single Jew couldn't have a gun, etc., and there was no possibility of resistance. In the case of Brian Mark Riggs' thesis, we have up to 150,000 full part and, you know, quarter Jewish individuals who were in the military and could well have started a revolt if they had been unified and had the will to do so. So it's not true that Jews were completely helpless and defenseless. And of course, during Kristallnacht, Jews did have guns. Why didn't they shoot? If guns are so valuable and they are going to protect us against government tyranny, why didn't they protect the Jews in the case of Kristallnacht 1938 to those who believe that Hitler was behind that?
Right. Now, they
weren't.
They weren't actually restricted in the March 18th, 1938 the Firearms Act. The thing that they could not do was to own gun shops or to own manufacturing companies that manufactured either guns or ammunition. But couldn't they own firearms? It does not say in the law that they could not.
I know that some Jews were asked to surrender their weapons. Heinz Weichart, who was a Jewish individual who finally emigrated after Kristallnacht 1938, he wrote a small essay that's introduced by J.B. Campbell, I can't, a Jewish Nazi or something like that. And he said that the Gestapo did come in. They took account of his, he had several weapons, several guns. They took account of them, but they did not seize them. There are other Jews who have claimed that they did have their guns seized. So I guess that really would be relying on eyewitness testimony. Some say it didn't happen, others say it did happen.
The law itself says that gypsies or vagabond persons, or those persons under the age of 18, legally incapacitated or mentally inferior persons, gypsies or vagabond persons, persons under mandatory police supervision, or who have been relieved of their civil rights, for as long as these remain under mandatory police supervision or remain stripped of their civil rights, persons convicted of treason or high treason, persons who, for a deliberate assault on the life or well-being of others, for breach of the peace or for trespass, for resistance to authority of the state, for a criminal offense or misdemeanor, for a criminal offense against property. There are several, stipulations.
It's possible that the Jews fell under the loss of civil liberties because they effectively did with the introduction of the Nuremberg Laws. Now, Hitler could circumvent that, and he left that to himself in the supplementary decree. I believe it's Article 7. The Führer could override anything he wanted and make exceptions wherever he wished to do so. So it is possible that the Jews who were suspected of instigating Kristallnacht, and also just Jews who had perhaps participated in some kind of resistance movement, did have their guns seized. And that may be the eyewitness accounts there that they said, my guns were taken, therefore there must have been gun control. So that's a good point. It's not specifically stated, even in the 1938 laws, that Jews can't have guns. So that to me tells me that Hitler was willing to kind of make exceptions and be somewhat lenient in that regard. And of course, the Nuremberg laws are the same way. There were many, many African American, or not African Americans, but Africans, Afro Germans, Africans, and mulattoes who were working under the protection of the NSDAP, as we've gone over that circular. That was issued by Martin Bormann to protect their employment. And in fact, it was the NSDAP protecting these Africans from employers who were discriminating against them of their own initiative. And the government was also against, acting against those Germans who basically said, I don't want to go to some shop that has this African employed there. So this would be individual racist Germans that were being counteracted by the NSDAP, which was supposed to be encouraging that kind of behavior in the Germans, as we're told. So yes, not everything is black and white as we see. And there was also the Africa show, where one of the reasons the German Africa show, that traveling show, was kept intact was to keep Africans employed that otherwise wouldn't have worked because of the discrimination. Of course, as we know, back in that day, discrimination against Africans in particular was everywhere. America, France, Poland was really bad, according to W.E.B. Du Bois. So that's another instance where, gee, the Nuremberg laws say that Africans were discriminated against, and they were second-class nobodies But were they really? I mean, there were exceptions, obviously, and the Nuremberg laws were being circumvented. So yeah, the whole civil liberties thing is, it could go either way. But to say that he didn't have any gun control isn't totally accurate, because obviously that's gun control. We, the government, are deciding who's mentally, if you know, deficient and okay to have a gun. I personally don't have a problem with that. I think that some people shouldn't have guns.
Exactly.
Repeated criminals, sociopaths, you know, they shouldn't have guns.
Exactly.
So I'm okay with that. And if the United States enacts some limitations like that, I don't think we should freak out and go, oh, they're coming for our guns, because that's not true. Actually, rounding up and seizing the guns in this country seems totally impossible to me anyway. There's so many. And then you just have a black market pop up. So I think people's fear in that regard is unfounded.
Right.
And then I guess we can move on to whatever's next. What would you like to address first?
All right. Did you want to talk about Condon's recent debate with John Friend?
Absolutely. Now, obviously, Condon has moved a little bit. He has slightly adjusted. And that's always a good thing, because if somebody adjusts a little bit, it means that they are willing to reconsider their position. Oddly, as psychology teaches us, oftentimes, a thesis that challenges someone's beliefs that have been long held actually solidifies those beliefs. He's not one of those. At least I don't perceive him as such, because he has adjusted. And I do think that John Friend was pretty effective at getting him to adjust even a little bit more. He really should read the essay I wrote based on the pools, because, you know, a couple of people have attacked that for being overly verbose. I don't think so at all. I'm not trying to be verbose. And I think John Friend a little bit misunderstood the premise behind the whole Nordic thing. And this other person who accused me of just being a bunch of words, you know, lots of verbiage to confuse you and make it seem like Hitler wasn't financed by Jews. Let me put it this way. America is a meta nation. It always has been. It was founded by Freemasons, and the Freemasons have always had the idea, at least for a very long time, perhaps not initially in the 1789 revolution in France, but certainly by the time communism came around and even a little bit before the Russian Revolution, they had the idea of world government. That Freemasonry is the truth and the light. It was behind the Enlightenment. It is behind liberalism today. It isn't leftist. It isn't communist. It is liberalism taken to an absolute divine extreme. They believe that everyone is either cowan, dogs, or profane. And they do refer to the world, to people like you and I, as the profane. They will lock you out of their meetings. I printed up like 4 PDFs straight from this Freemasonic website. Read them a couple times now. They're just extremely arrogant. Sexist as well. Women are not allowed in, and it's always been that way. They can be an auxiliary like a Shriner, but they're never allowed to be an actual Mason.
Or like Eastern Star or something like that.
Yes, and that to me is very strange. I don't like movements that ban women, because women tend to be the social consciousness. Women provide men with their conscience, with their moral conscience. Men lose their scruples when they don't have women to keep them in check. Even Hitler had women around him, notice. And you know what? Every time he talked to Leni Riefenstahl or Winifred Wagner about something, he was always checked a little bit. And she'd always come up with, well, you know, if you're just take it easy on those Jews. I know you hate them, but and he would go, all right, you know. So it's very important. So that to me makes me, it disturbs me deeply about Freemasonry. And I do believe that that is what is the main vehicle for, you know, the whole Zionist power we have now, Jewish supremacy and Jewish power. The two are intertwined. But basically with the whole Freemason thing, You know, I just lost my train of thought.
Well, they
I don't
took.
know where I'm going with that now. I
I
was
do
going
that
somewhere.
frequently. But they did, well, because the Freemason lodges were already set up in the late 1700s, it was very appropriate, and they exploited the organization and just infiltrated it, and then changed the whole scope of Freemasonry from what it was to what it is now.
Right, that's really the force behind this New World Order and this globalism. Now, I've completely lost where I was going with that, and I apologize because it was important. It may come back to me, but wow, that doesn't happen very often. But okay, I guess we can go on to let me just start with the Dunkirk. Oh wait, what were we talking about before that? What myth? We were on gun control, and then what were we addressing?
Well,
Maybe it'll come
there
back to me.
was a con that maintains that Hitler may not have committed suicide, that he destroyed his own birth records, that he may have been a Jew, that he let the Britzies off at Dunkirk,
Right.
which I covered also in a brief radio program.
Right.
And he implied that he allowed the Allies to destroy Germany and that he played a much bigger part in getting the Jews to Palestine than he did. And he also used a lot of the same sources that he used in his video, Kershaw and Sutton and Douglas Reed and.
Right. Okay, well, let me just go with the Dunkirk thing. It may come back to me, it may not. Okay, so the first thing is there's a good book called Dunkirk, The Patriotic Myth, Nicholas Harman. That explains a lot. That gives you all the complexities of who thought what, why did they halt, what was going on, how was the ground, how was the terrain, what was Guderian's whole thing. Let's just put it this way. This was the whole combined arms with tanks leading the way, punching through the defense, and then the infantry following up and encircling from behind, etc. That was revolutionary. This had never happened before. Tobias Yersok argues that Hitler was kind of spooked by how fast the advance was going, and he wasn't the only one. It was mainly General Gerd von Rundstedt. He's like, whoa, 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 this ain't happening. Halt. Okay, and Rundstedt did in fact order the halt order, which is what that one caller he called in and said that. He's absolutely
Right,
correct. Now, I don't
exactly.
know about Rommel. I do have the Rommel papers, but they're so thick. I mean, it's probably like 800 pages. I haven't actually read what Rommel said about that, but there were generals like Rundstedt, etc., who were concerned about how far back the infantry was, etc., in relation to the panzers. And they said, you need to stop. You need to give them time to come up. What if something happens? And in the Dunkirk, the patriotic myth, that guy, proves that there was some resistance from these very poorly armed BEF forces. So we must not be under the impression that the Germans just flew to the beaches totally unresisted. That's not true. That's part of the myth. There was resistance, and it in fact stalled the advance. So that's the first thing. You're dealing with the old school who's going, you can't do warfare like that. This is insane. And of course, Hitler's going, oh my gosh, if anything bad happens, it's on me. I'm going to be a clown. And I mean, he was very concerned with his image, how he was doing things. He was very successful up to that point. He didn't want to blow that, because that could hurt the confidence he had with the German people. Okay, he didn't want them spooked. Like, your fear is really a buffoon and doesn't know what he's doing. Look at what happened here in France. So of course he's thinking, my reputation, I don't want to be a laughing stock of the British press, etc. If something happens here, maybe Rundstedt's right. Maybe this is too much. And of course the youngins like Guderian and whatnot, he wrote a treatise on this. He was all about this kind of warfare. He's like, what are you old hens cackling about? Get over it, dude. We're doing fine. There's no problem. They'll catch up. It's going well. And of course, he prevailed for a while. But then Rundstedt, he's like, this can't keep going. So yes, that issue is far more complicated than what Condit wants to believe. And of course, I would only add to that, if Hitler was in fact a British agent, minus this whole Dunkirk thing, then why did he deal the hardest blow to the British Empire it ever endured? As we see, Britain lost its whole entire empire as a direct result of World War II, and Hitler allowed Subhas Chandra Bose, the Grand Mufti, all these small nationalist, anti-colonial factions and groups to use Berlin as their platform to inform the world what was going on in, you know, under British Raj in Palestine, with the Britzies indiscriminately bombing Arab villages, etc., murdering women and children, doing the things they were doing. They would burn them out of their homes. They were basically enacting their own little form of three-all campaign, which we're always talking about the Japanese and their three-alls campaign in China, which was very ruthless. Mm-hmm. But the Britzies were doing the same thing in Palestine.
Right.
So, and if people don't like to hear the terms Jutsis and Britzies, then you don't need to listen to my programs anymore. I had a couple people on that Grizzom blog. Oh, I wish you'd quit doing that. Now I'll be doing that more just because you said that now. And of course, in Albion and Zion United, and Wilfried doesn't like it. He's all, oh, I just don't like reading that Britzy Jutsy Yankee Sophie thing. I said, too bad. And of course, the Masons are the Mazis. A lot of people didn't know what that was. They're the Mazis, the Masons.
Okay.
It's going to be in the book. I think it adds a lot of character to it. And
oh,
it will
sure.
certainly be the first time that's
original.
It is original. And of course, the Werewolves is original as it is. The whole structure of my books is, it's totally unorthodox.
And that's okay.
That's how it's, I write a certain way. And, you know, people either love it or hate it, I guess. So.
Right.
So that's the whole Dunkirk thing.
Now, the Dunkirk Myth, the Patriotic Myth by Nicholas Harmon.
Great book. I think I got mine for a penny.
Oh, wow.
It's on Amazon. You pay more for the shipping than you do the book.
Right.
Okay. So, yeah, pick that up. People should read that. The Rommel Papers. You could probably get that for close to a penny. And we must understand. Go ahead.
I'm kind of concerned about the publisher, Simon & Schuster, which are
very... You can still get decent. They still have those... It's amazing, but even Holocaust survivor memoirs have these amazing little tidbits that you'd Like when they were shot two times in the stomach over a period of like 3 or 4 days and were hiding in and out of haystacks, etc.
Uh-huh.
No. Nobody gets shot in the stomach, continues to run, hiding under hay, and somehow survives it all until they get to a doctor 2 or 3 days later. And yet this is the kind of stuff we read in some of these memoirs. We know that is fiction. That just isn't possible. I mean, unless the person was grazed in the stomach. You're not getting shot into your stomach with a bullet and surviving that without medical attention.
Exactly.
Especially back then, you know, hiding in hay where it can get infected. I'm just, no. Okay, so. I guess, you know what? I just remember where I was going with that Freemason thing, the Jewish exploitation of Freemasonry. What they were doing is they were basically, the Freemasons were exploiting the fratricide, the traditional fratricide that had been going on between the Germans and the Anglo-Saxons already. And of course, the Freemasons were on the side of the Anglo-Saxons. And who was it that gets into that? I think it might be Springborn. Basically, what one of these Germans argues is that why is it that Freemasonry supports the government of England and France, whereas German Freemasonry is against Germanness and the German government always. It's always pro-English or pro-French. That
well,
was
didn't
a very
Hitler
good
throw
point.
Them out?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But if these Masons are so all about tolerance and diversity and multiculturalism and everyone's equal kind of a thing, which is what they promote, even though they're very sexist and racist, then why were they always against the German government? Even German Masons were. They were always pro-English, pro-French, and even the Italian Masons were anti-Italian. They didn't like the Italian government. They wanted it to be in line with English and French policy. So we need to ask ourselves that. Why is that that the Masons of Germany and Italy were not supportive of their own governments? It's obvious that Freemasonry is an English and eventually Jewish organization, and French. And of course, the French and English have always sided with one another against Germany, etc. England is very good at exploiting different countries at any given time to maintain their power. Even today, they somehow keep their economy going, and I don't even know what England produces anymore. It's incredible. How does England as a country have any power today? I would like someone to answer that. They don't produce anything. They're just a finance country, really. It's very strange. I mean, obviously, there's shenanigans behind the scenes there, but I think that that proves the point about the Freemasons. They are specifically Anglo-Saxon, and then the Jews came in later because what they did is they said, well, you Masons, you can't discriminate. Look at what you're doing. You're anti-Semitic. You need to let us in. And they did. They felt all humanitarian and said, oh, we need to let the Jews in. We can't discriminate. And that's when that started. So Freemasonry isn't actually Jewish. The Jews infiltrated Freemasonry and made it conform to their own ends, which is what they do with many movements. Communism is another example. Now, Stalin broke with the Bolshevism, the Jewish Bolshevism, and he basically was a Russian imperialist, full-blown imperialism in Europe. And I really don't think that Stalin was behind the Comintern in the same way that his predecessors and those after him were. Because the Comintern kind of came back alive after Stalin's death. So he was more or less an imperialist who simply used communism for his own ends. And that's why he had to be taken down. And that's why he was eventually rejected by the Jews. But that's another example where they just got in on a movement where the people were fed up with being exploited by the government. The czars were horrible rulers. They weren't good to the Russian masses. And that's why communism and that whole egalitarian idea got the foothold it did. We're starting to see the same thing spring up in America. Capitalism, I think the core problem with capitalism is that it produces winners and losers. There is no mitigation there. Unless the capitalist system has the middle class, it's nothing but bitterness for those who aren't at the top. And that's where we're headed. And so, you know, the inevitable result is either socialism or you have an incredible terroristic overthrow and revolution.
Right.
And then whoever happens to be the savviest and the best at winning the public opinion propaganda war is the one who gets to lead it, which is what the Jews did with communism. They were the best at exploiting those hatreds, and they got into power. And then, of course, when Stalin got in there, that was a little bit of a different story. He started liquidating them and giving them a run for their money.
Yeah, but I wonder if that was somehow just propaganda, because he left some in and some he got rid of. And was that just some sort of play to get rid of just certain ones, or to make them look like they were being targeted? Because if you think about the date, it was 1938 when the mock trials were set up. And I really haven't studied it thoroughly, but I have wondered, because we still have a lot of Jews there.
That's true. Of course, we still have a lot of Jews coming back into Germany, too. Hitler left some Jews in. Manstein was Jewish. And I've had people try to argue out of that one. No. I believe it was this matrilineal line was Levinsky Levy. He was Jewish. He was really General von Levinsky. His name was changed, just like Hitler's was changed. He was not really Manstein. So he was Hitler's Jewish general. By Jewish definition, he was a Jew, a full-blooded Jew, because his mother was. It was the matrilineal line. So, and of course, Rig gets into that, and there have been people attacking him on the premise that, well, these weren't real Jews. Oh, yes, they were. It depends on which law you're going by. Some go by the father's line, some go by the mother's line. That's why he gets into the halakha law, etc., Orthodox versus unorthodox, and of course, Jews that go, there is no Jewish race that has nothing to do with it. He addresses all that in his definitions. Mm-hmm. So no, he deals that a blow. But yeah, I mean, Hitler had Jews in there, so I don't see how it's much different. I think if we look at Stalin's policies, he really was bent on invading for more or less Muscovy, is how Alfred Rosenberg described it, Pan-Slavism, the Slav rising kind of a thing, with the Russian, the great Russian, as it were, as at the head of this, into Europe. You Europeans are done. You're over. You got this liberalistic, filthy culture, etc. You're done. You're over. You're going down. So we're going to come in and take over it and return it to this peasant soil. There's a very similar kind of Germania mentality within Slavism. And I think too many historians discount that. There's one author who doesn't. It's German rule in Russia, 1941 to 1945. Alexander Dahlin. I had to pay $80 for this book. And I think the next cheapest one was like 100 something or 200. If one is willing to spend it, do it. It's very good. He's great. He runs with a lot of the traditional myths about how horrible the Germans were in Russia, etc. But he also undercuts his own argument in many areas. He exonerates Rosenberg, as far as I'm concerned. Rosenberg was interested in giving the Ukrainians and some others in Eastern Europe complete sovereignty. But then when that didn't quite cut the cheese with Hitler, he's like, wait, complete sovereignty? I don't think so. You know, we're liberating them and administering their governments right now. I don't think so. This is going to be like a United States of Europe with the German as the kind of foundation of this federal confederation of European states. He was, in Hitler's mind, he was thinking, I'm going to make America in Europe. His manifest destiny was Western Russia, and he was going to stop there and kind of wall off Russia proper and keep them off to the east. There was no extermination or anything in the planning. But it's a good book because he gives treatment to that whole Pan-Slavic idealism that, you know, the Slavs had.
Okay, now which book is it? The German Rule in Russia?
Mm-hmm. Alexander Dahlin.
Okay.
Or Dahlin. You might be able to get a PDF of it. You never know.
Right.
Sometimes Scribd has some good ones like that. It's an older book, but it's very good. I'll just read this one little thing on, this is actually from an online source, Spartacus International, which is very anti-German, but sometimes they drop some cherry bombs. By May 14th, 1940, the German tanks led by General Heinz Guderian crossed the Meuse and had opened up a 50-mile gap in the Allied front. Rundstedt had doubts about the aggressive tactics of Guderian and argued that his tanks should halt and wait until infantry divisions could catch up. Rundstedt did not fully understand Blitzkrieg tactics and wanted a conventional assault on the BEF. Adolf Hitler agreed, and this decision stopped Guderian cutting off the escape of the British and French troops from Dunkirk. And of course, Rundstedt turned out to be an anti-Hitler conspirator. He's the one that urged Hitler to negotiate a peace settlement with the Allies. So we need to be a little bit careful with Rundstedt. He may have been working for the English.
Mm-hmm.
As
some
many
of them
of
were.
Us, yeah. Oh, yeah. So many of the German elite generals. So, yeah, that's very important. But Rundstedt had a very powerful, prominent position. He was very popular. He was kind of Germany's first soldier, regarded as the war's most brilliant strategist. So, you know, Hitler wanted to be a little careful stepping on his toes, as I'm sure we can understand.
Sure.
And then, of course, I mean, I think Condit's backed off of the Strait of Gibraltar thing. You can't just do that. Hitler couldn't just drop ships in the Strait of Gibraltar. If we recall, the reason Hitler met with Francisco Franco was to try to bring him on board so he could do that. He's like, look, I need your cooperation here. We rubbed your back. We saved you from communism in your Spanish Civil War. I think you owe us this much. And Hitler wasn't even asking that much. He rebuffed Hitler. He said, no way. Hitler was irate. He wrote a nice little letter to Mussolini about Francisco Franco that I'll have to send you sometime. But he's like, he was just really rude. And what an unappreciative thing. You know, the Germans really did win his civil war for him. They were really what put Francisco Franco in power. It's incredible. But at the same time, Winston Churchill was bribing Francisco Franco's generals to persuade him to stay neutral against Hitler. So Churchill, the conniving devil he was, did get in there. And I have that in the Union Jackal, all those shenanigans.
Okay.
And of course, I guess we can go on to, how about Sutton?
Oh, yes. Absolutely. Cover Sutton.
Okay, so here we go. Okay, go ahead.
That book is now up to $155.
And you might be able to get a cheaper one. Sometimes they'll have a new edition.
Well, I checked in. I have a subscription to Questia, which is a very good site. And they have a lot of books, and you just pay, I think it's, $100 or something, or maybe $200 a year. And they have a lot of really old books. I mean, thousands upon thousands of books. Mm-hmm. And you can just open them up, and they don't have that book, German Rule in Russia. So they don't have everything, but they have a lot of books.
Oh, darn it. Maybe I'll have to just scan it. It would be a long scan. It's a huge book, but yeah, it's up there in price because it's so rare. Okay, well, if worse comes to worse, I can always scan it. But basically, Sutton's thesis. I don't understand. I would like somebody to send one of us the specific sections where he actually proves anything.
Exactly.
Because Sidney Warburg didn't exist. Okay, he's a figment of someone's clever imagination. And of course, we looked into this because in the Sidney Warburg memoir, he says that Goering spoke Italian. So here we go. The Sidney Warburg Chronicle is pure fabrication. Wilfried Heinck's IFZ inquiry yielded the following inconvenient fact about Goering, just one among several discussed in the Hyenas of High Finance, that exposed the Sidney Warburg book as a fraud. The correspondence reads as follows, and of course this was sent in German and translated here. Wilf says, what it says is that, of course, you could have contacted them directly and that they only have copies of the letters. However, these letters are genuine. The handwritten letters by Goering are in German and that it could not be called a correspondence because only Goering's letters are available. Now, these would have been the letters to Negrelli, the Italian minister who he was in, the Italian official Leo Negrelli, who he was corresponding with. According to Sidney's book, Goering spoke fluent Italian. And I say, oh, really? Then why did Goering handwrite a letter to Italian official Leo Negrelli in German instead of Italian?
Exactly.
That's a problem. And why did he need a translator when he went? Gee, I wonder. So those kind of silly mistakes all throughout. Of course, they're always meeting in some anonymous, obscure beer cellar. And Hitler is constantly slamming his fists on the table. Listen here. No, he did not speak that way to a man who's about to finance him with millions of dollars. Okay. And then, of course, there was one other thing that is in the Jackal that is not in the essay I have online about the demystification of the birth and funding of the NSDAP. And that is that Robert Ley, that's L-E-Y, told Hitler, hey, you know, you do realize that with your newfound power, you can seize all of the assets of the labor unions? And Hitler goes, oh, really? Okay, then I think I'll do that. And that's exactly what they did. So the mystery funding of 1933 is the 184 million marks that were hoarded by the predominantly communist Jutsist labor unions. So there you have it.
Yes.
So Condit had asked about, well, where did that money come from in 1933? Hello, hello. That's where it came from, 184 million marks. And of course, I guess you could attack Hitler on the premise that he grabbed all the money of the labor unions, but it was perfectly legal and in his right to do so as chancellor. So that's really beyond any kind of argument. And then, of course, you have Detterding and the coal companies that right. took care of him in the early 30s. There's a book called German Big Business and the Rise of Hitler. And that is, I believe that's Henry Ashby Turner. There's an essay written about that book. It's on Justice for Germans. He has a link on the right.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes to that essay. Yeah, it's Henry Ashby Turner.
Okay.
He negates the myth that Hitler was funded by big business. So he gets rid of that. He goes, look, big business, IG Farben, Krupp Steel, yada, yada, yada. No, they weren't behind Hitler. Sorry.
Right.
So there were companies that were. There were industrialists that were, especially after Hitler put out that incredibly well-reasoned pamphlet to them, appealing to them. But it's a myth that IG Farben and whatnot were there from the beginning. That is total myth.
Right.
So we can get over that one real quick.
Well, even the Sutton thing. You sent me a link, and I've read the article by Michael Collins Piper. He did a short article for American Free Press, Bush, Rockefeller, Rothschild, and Hitler, and
right.
he also mentioned Sutton. And so I don't know why.
Where are the citations? Yeah, somebody needs to send us the citations where it actually says something of any meaning.
Right, because people keep using him to make that
it's
claim.
It's really frustrating because it's not in there. Basically, Sutton has an awful thesis because he's arguing one thing and concluding another.
Right.
That's not a good thesis. So it passes over those who don't understand kind of a more master's level argument. One can say, oh, yeah, the Rothschilds were there. Where? Give me the evidence. Okay, so then they tell you Schroeder. Mm-hmm. Schrader. Okay, so let's go over that one. In later years, this is from Alan Dulles. This is a book on Alan Dulles.
Oh, and we're certainly going to believe that.
No, you need to read. This is important. This is one of those cherry bombs in a mainstream book. I'll let you know what book this is. In later years, these visits and the Dulles brothers' position on the Schroeder U.S. branch's board of directors would be used by Soviet disinformation agents to allege that both men had maintained ties with the German bankers who financed Adolf Hitler's rise to power. Soviet disinformation. So this is the whole Dulles connection that everyone's screeching about. Oh, well, how do you explain Dulles and his financing of Hitler? This canard gained credence by repetition to the point that it is now stated as fact in most Dulles family biographies that Foster and Allen maintained discreditable ties to the Nazis before, during, and after World War II. The proof offered was that a Schroeder bank in Germany was run by a Hitler loyalist, Baron Kurt von Schroeder, and that the brothers were therefore indicted by implication. In addition to the different spelling of the surname, the lie ignores the fact that the Schroeder firm was an all-Britzy institution founded in 1804 in London, and that there was no German subsidiary of it called Schroeder's. Moreover, the bank General von Schroeder applied his name to was the Cologne banking house of J.H. Stein, which he commandeered when he retired from military service. This was easy enough after 33 when a spate of Nazi laws made Jutze ownership of key industries and financial institutions illegal. So here's a real good question, people. If Rothschild and the Jutzes funded Hitler, then why did the Nazi laws make Jutze ownership of key industries and finance institutions illegal? And why? Please tell me why. As documented in Adam Labor's Hitler's Secret Backers, one of the best books I've ever read.
Yeah, I have that book. It's very
Secret
good.
Secret Bankers. One of the best books I've ever read, even though it's written by a Hitler. He's got all kinds of great stuff in there.
Yes, he does.
Why were the Jews, their money was flying out of Germany right after Hitler was elected. He had to put a moratorium on offshoring of wealth because so much Jutze money was leaving the country as a direct result of his election.
Mm-hmm.
We must ask that question, and it was going straight to Switzerland. Why offshore if your man is a Jewish agent? Okay, that's they can't get around that one. Absolutely cannot. Now, if they want to try to go, well, let's see. That was the Jutsi's convoluted plan to like have it offshored so that somehow Hitler could like go after it, and that led to the Holocaust, and therefore Zionists benefited. No. We're not going into strange maze labyrinths to come up with some stupid convoluted thesis to explain that. Hitler was anti-Jutsist. That is the conclusion from that. That's not going to somehow be turned on to the Zionists as though they were responsible for that. Well, we're going to make sure our agent Hitler passes laws against our people so that, you know, we can't have banks and stuff there so that we look persecuted and then we'll get Palestine. No. That whole modus came in only in the very end of the war when things were totally in shambles. And the Zionist went, hey, this is a perfect time to create the sympathy we need because they couldn't get it earlier. The Peel Plan, and Ingrid Veckert describes that in detail in Jewish Emigration from the Third Reich and Flashpoint book. She talks about the Peel Plan and how the Zionists were initially a fail. They failed to get Palestine at that time. So then the end of the war, all the chaos, Jews are coming in from the east, all these displaced people, perfect timing. We want to go to Palestine now. We have the sympathy. We got the Holocaust story. That came in later. But to say this started this early, if that's the case, then Jutsis deserve to rule the world. If they're that brilliant and they have that kind of foresight, then we're no match, clearly. So there never was any proof that Sullivan and Cromwell or the Dulles brothers or the London Schroeder Bank ever had any ties to or dealings with von Schluter, but the lie lives on. So there you have it. Schroeder, Schluter, not the same thing. So that's even more information than I had. But basically, all I said with it, it was basically a conglomeration of industrialists, big coal, a couple financial institutions, J.H. Stein and Schluter, who got together with von Papen, and they said, "Okay, we sure as heck don't want the communists in power, and they've got more seats now that we've kind of pushed the Nazis into the evil propaganda, realm. We've demonized them. That wasn't good because all it did was benefit the communists. We definitely don't want them in power. Maybe we should give this Hitler guy the chancellorship." That's all that happened. There isn't some incredible conspiracy behind Hitler's appointment to the chancellorship, etc., etc. So here's basically the breakdown I have of this, and I provide this chart in the Jackal. It's also in that essay. One can see, just looking at that chart, that the NSDAP lost most of its 230 seats of July 1932 to the even more radical Revolutionary Communist Party, KPD, in November 1932, 4 months later, not to conservative Catholics or the Social Democrats. The conservative nationalists, DNVP, only gained 15 seats. These results, contrary to most historiography, do not imply the demise of the NSDAP, but the masses' disaffection with any party that was not willing to promise sweeping social and economic change for the majority, even if it meant bloodshed. So basically, Hitler and the NSDAP were not viewed as extreme enough, and they lost seats to the KPD in alarming numbers. Doesn't mean the Nazis were on their way out the door, and all of a sudden, this miracle financing comes and saves them for Zionism. The communists were getting those seats. So the masses were going, okay, you're not going to do it. We'll go with the communists. We'll have bloodshed if we need it. And it makes perfect sense to me. And so Papen and his little goonies got all freaked out and they're like, okay, Hitler isn't a communist. I know you don't like his socialism, but look, dude, he's okay with some capitalism, etc. Get him in. And that's what they did. And they thought they were going to keep him controlled. Little did they know, Hitler had quite a will, quite a personal will. I don't think anyone can deny that. It's just amazing what he pulled off there. And then, of course, I guess we could go to the This is the chapter, A Tale of Two Bankers, and I had submitted this to you a long time ago. It's been like over a year. And this is where David Irving is saying that Heinrich Bruning talked about these two mysterious bankers who funded Hitler, blah, blah, blah. It's in that article, Rothschilds Funded Hitler and Churchill.
Uh-huh.
That's Powerwolf right now. Let me read this specific. Yeah. Right here. Heinrich Bruning wrote to Churchill in a 1937 letter. I didn't, and do not even today, for understandable reasons, wish to reveal from October 1928 the two largest regular contributors to the Nazi Party were the general managers of two of the largest Berlin banks, both of Jewish faith, and one of them the leader of Zionism in Germany. Now, this individual pointed this out, and I encourage people to check up on his information, but I don't doubt that he's probably correct here. There never has been a Rothschild Bank of Berlin. It has never and does not exist. Now, there's no mention of Rothschilds there, of course. He doesn't say. He says, I'm not going to reveal. Well, isn't that quaint? Heinrich Bruning, who was backed by Jutzi, Big Jutzi Finance, isn't going to tell us who they were. I mean, how idiotic. And I mean, people are putting this guy up on a honesty pedestal.
Right.
Now, I wrote this chapter addressing that very thing. A Tale of Two Bankers, Chapter 6 in the Union Jackal. And I say this is all well and good, but what were these two mystery men's names and what was written in the 1949 letter? Okay, what? We don't even know what's in this letter other than that part. And of course, I go on to say, has anyone actually seen one or both of these letters, or must we rely on hearsay from Bruning and Churchill interpreted by historian David Irving? So we don't know that these letters were actually reproduced verbatim or copied, that these are copies of the originals. We have no idea. It could just be hearsay that Churchill just wrote this in his biographies he wrote.
Sure.
You know, autobiography that's like a million pages about World War II.
Right.
So we don't know that. We need to check up on that. And then had Bruning admitted to lying? And, you know, maybe he did. And we just haven't come across that information yet. Leader of the World Zionist Organization in Germany between 1911 and 1921 was the botanist Otto Warburg, who died in none other than Hitler's anti-Jutsi terror state in 1938. And the leader from 1921 to 31, as well as from 35 to 46, was none other than Chaim Weizmann, who was criticized by fellow Zionists for being too pro-British. So the leader from 21 to 31, which is when this applies, 1928, the Bruning letter, was Chaim Weizmann. He wasn't a banker. So how is that one of the leaders of the Zionist movement?
Mm-hmm.
That Bruning thing is absolute bunk. It's just total nonsense. So we can get over that. But just real quick, Heinrich Bruning was a Hitler enemy backed by Jutsi mega-capitalist Paul Silverberg. And then, of course, Weizmann was president of the British Zionist Federation, not the German Zionist Federation. And they were the ones in March 1918 pushing for Palestine to the British government, not Hitler or the German government. And I question how James Poole missed such a contributor. If this guy had produced that much money, it was that crucial, how did James Poole miss him and who financed Hitler? And I think that's about all that's really pertinent there. And all I have is now, if we're talking about the Schluters, they did not provide any credit to Hitler until 1933 via Schacht. So it wasn't the Schluters. And of course, the Jewishness, the part Jewishness of the Schluters is hearsay. That's never been proven. I came across one reference to Schluter being half Jewish or quarter Jewish, but again, it was hearsay.
Mm-hmm.
It was the Daily Mail or something like that. And I haven't been able to find it since, but people might be able to find that. It's either the Daily Mail or the Telegraph where it was. It was just a very brief line about his part Jewish lineage. It wasn't Jacob Schiff who had died in 1920. So who else is there? What other Jutsi banker who might have been involved with Zionism is there who could have funded him in 28?
Exactly.
There are none, people. Zero. They don't exist. Shadows. And of course, we do have Emil Georg von Strauss, the general director of Deutsche Bank and chairman of the board of directors of Daimler-Benz, AG, Lufthansa, and BMW, actually developed close ties to Hitler via Hermann Göring and Henry Detterding. But he didn't come along until later. And of course, he was very anti-Jutsi. And I have written here, he never actually joined the Nazi party, the NS party. But when Strauss's friendly relations with the party became well known, Deutsche Bank Jutsi customers switched to other banks. He later helped Deutsche Bank profit from NS praxis, such as the Germanization of hundreds of Jutsi businesses. So this guy helped Germanize Jutsi banks and other institutions and booted the Jews out. So, hi, he's not Zionist Jewish people. And of course, von Strauss is not Jewish. No one has ever even partially tried to argue that. And his name isn't Strauss. It's Strauss with no S. So we can't pull the Levi Strauss thing. Oh, well, he must be Jewish because his name is Strauss. No, I'm not necessarily. And I guess that's about it. And just real briefly, let me go over some of these numbers, because of course everybody tries to say Hitler founded Israel.
Which is ridiculous.
Yeah. So let me give you the numbers I have in the Jackal. Between 1922 and 1931, long before Hitler's even in power, an estimated 90,816 Jutsis had immigrated to Palestine. Okay, where did they come from? They weren't on Hitler's tab, obviously. Okay, and about 300,000 emigrated between 31 and 41, only 60 to 70,000 of whom did so under the auspices of Hitler's transfer agreement. Where did the other 230,000 emigrate from? And these are the questions no one asks. Are we really going to blame Hitler for that? Because a war was going on, because Hitler was doing what he needed to do for Europe. He was enacting his will and German agenda. We're going to blame him for creating this context? No. You need to blame the ones who declared war on Hitler, which is the Britzies and the French. Right. Using Poland as their proxy.
Right. And a lot of them also came out of Poland.
Absolutely. And of course, I can see how somebody might go, well, because Hitler created the context of war, well, the Jews had to immigrate. Mm-hmm. You know, where else were they supposed to go? I mean, he still created that context. That's really quaint. But what we can say is, no, the white race created that context, because it was a white on white fratricide that created the result of Israel, wasn't it? So if we're going to go that route, let's just blame the white race. It's white people's fault. It certainly wasn't Africans. It certainly wasn't, you know, Native Americans or South American Indians or create the context for Jewish emigration. It was white people's. So if we're going to blame Hitler, I guess we should just blame the white race. You see, that really undercuts their whole argument there. Because it was everybody going to war with each other that created that context.
Right.
Leading to the Holocaust, etc. And, of course, the State of Israel was a result of that war. So, and then from 1941 to 50, 730,000 emigrated there. Far more than ever before. And yet Hitler was the fervent Zionist and helper of Jews.
Right.
Of course, I wanted to add one more thing. Stalin outlawed Zionism in the USSR, so does that make him the hero of World War II? And of course, everyone says, well, communism was Zionist and Stalin was a Zionist stooge. Well, then why did he outlaw Zionism? Or did he do that to, like, help Zionists get Palestine somehow in a convoluted thesis?
Right.
Just what some of these people might try to come up with.
Well, given that Zionism began long, long time before Hitler came to power, before he was ever born, how can you blame Hitler and claim that he created Palestine or Israel? It's ridiculous.
It's insane. Now, Wolf Meyer gives the following statistics, and I'm only going to read the relevant ones. But basically, he says that the promotion of emigration is at the center of Zionist politics. This is going to be Albion and Zion United now. So I'm reading from that. And the following statistic shows the result of these politics. Now he starts in the year 1920 and how 10,000 immigrated. And he goes all the way to 1932 before Hitler. So we have 122,714 Jutsis immigrating to Palestine before Hitler is even chancellor. This is from 1920 to 1932. That is officially recognized. That's official data. That doesn't include illegal or unofficial. So we don't know if there were others. Then from 33 to 37, we have, I believe that was 80,000. In 33, we have 41,000. 34, we have 42,000. 35, we have 61,000. 36, we have 29,000. And 37, we have 10,500. His grand total is 308,517. So I have 80,000. I think that was 80. Wait, no. 185,803 minus the 80,000 that emigrated while Hitler was in power. So we have 105,803 unaccounted for. Okay, so we know that 60 to 70,000 in 1933 under Hitler's auspices. How many illegally? We don't know. Give or take maybe 10,000. But that would put Hitler at 80,000. So let's just pretend 10,000 illegally emigrated under 60 to 70,000 that were officially transferred under the Havana Agreement, 80,000 under Hitler. Where did the other 105,803 unaccounted for in that time period come from? From 33 to 37. Because if you add it all up, we have 105,800 unaccounted for from other areas that were not under Havana. So how did Hitler found Israel?
Didn't. And if you read Walter Sanning's book, I mean, that is such a good book for all the facts and figures and who went where and how many of the Jews from Poland and other places actually went into the Soviet Union. And then at the end of the war, then you have a whole bunch of Jews that are missing. They just aren't in the where we would expect to find them or where the propagandists would indicate that they were. So...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then he also concludes from his other figures. He says, therefore, 50,000 Jutsis must have immigrated to Palestine in 1939 alone.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got 725 European Jutsis that immigrated illegally to Palestine in the week of January 21st to the 27th.
Right.
So the true extent of illegal immigration is unknown. Now, we know that Hitler only had 60 to 70,000 under Havara. But they have 50,000 in 1939 alone. Okay, these aren't under Hitler, people. These are coming from other areas.
Mm-hmm.
It's the England, the British, as Meyer proves, with more than enough evidence. His book is really going to be the nail in the coffin.
Okay, now what is his name?
It's Wolf Meyer, and his book is only available in German, but that's the translation that... Wilf and I did.
Oh,
so
right.
It's coming out. That's going to be, I'll be on in Zion United, the first book. So that'll all be in there and people can read that.
Good. Tell us about your latest books on Amazon.
Oh, the ones, the Controversy of Black Nazis 2, etc.?
Yeah, The Other Nazis, Managing Our Perceptions of the Third Reich.
The Other Nazis is my interview with Frank Joseph, who you had on. Just so people know, he's Jewish.
Exactly.
Which makes his interview all the more interesting. In fact, he's someone else. I don't know if you want to reveal that, though.
Go ahead.
He is the founder of... Is he the founder of the American Nazi Party or just took over after Rockwell?
He just took over after Rockwell passed away, died,
Joseph
was assassinated.
Cohen. Frank Collins, Frank Cohen.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Okay, so that's an interview with him. He's always ever been nice to me, but just so people know, well, heads up. And of course, one can read the beginning of that interview on the little look inside feature. So you can see if you're interested in reading more. And I just want to thank the individual who sent me the picture of that one unidentified mulatto in Hitler's army, because it's one of the best pictures I've seen. And that's in the little interview part you can, or the example. You can see his picture, and I have him on the front cover of The Controversy of Black Nazis 2. He knows who he is, so I just want to thank him for sending that to me. And I do, in fact, I finally found a copy of Ken Magazine. This was only published in 38 and 39, and it's just one NS bashing article after another. Just a very interesting magazine, though. But I was able to find the copy on eBay with the Black Nazis article. And it says, Black Nazis, Fritz Delfs, who I believe is actually Franz Wimmer Lomquist incognito, leader of the Nazis in Tanganyika, the former German East Africa that Hitler's demanding soft pedals Aryan supremacy credo in propounding Nazi ideology and capitalizes traditional use of the swastika by the natives as a symbol of fertility. Large percentage of population is half-caste and half-breeds. Quadroons and octoroons are included in the count. That is the basis of Berlin's claim that a third of the white population of Tanganyika is German. Even full-blooded Negroes are sporting swastika symbols and party buttons. That is Ken Magazine, March 23rd, 1939, page 9. And I have the actual magazine. So, of course, that the scan of that image in that article is in a couple of these, actually, that I just put out, these ebooks. Right. So people and, can see that.
Yes, and they are Kindle edition version, they're very reasonably priced, and you can get those on Amazon.
Yeah, they're too short to be books, but basically the one with the interview with Frank Joseph is just all the different people that were in the service of the Reich. It talks a little bit about the evolution of the Allgemeine SS into the Waffen-SS, how the NSDAP's racial attitudes were changed as a direct result of the war. And people need to understand that war is always a revolution, generally always a revolutionary process. If it's a total war, unlike like a limited territorial war or something like that, this was a world-changing war, very revolutionary in every respect. And as with any revolutionary war, it changed attitudes. And so by the end of the war, you have all these NSDAP members reneging on their racial views and going, well, we couldn't win it alone. We really aren't that great, are we? We needed help. And so you see that. And it's important that people understand that. The Germans couldn't do it alone.
Of course not. I mean, they were surrounded and
space, quote unquote. And oh, by the way, the Germans got the term, this is in Dahlen's book, they got the term Untermensch straight from an American Anglo-Saxon, Lothrop Stoddard. He used the term subhuman, which was then translated by the Germans. They went, oh, okay, that maybe that's an apt way to describe these people we see that just seem so kind of like degenerated for whatever reason under Bolshevism, etc. And so it was an American Anglo-Saxon that gave the Germans the term Untermensch in the first place. Just thought that was interesting trivia.
Yeah.
And of course, master race comes from an American as well. I believe it was Madison Grant. But yes, that is another American Anglo-Saxon term that the Germans, the only way they could kind of like translate that or explain that was Heidenvolk. And it's not the same. It just isn't the same. It doesn't mean master race. So master race is an English Anglo-Saxon idea. The Heidenvolk idea is different. It's not master servant. It just has a different connotation to it. And one has to read on the whole folkish, you know, movement and all of that to really understand Heidenvolk. It's more or less white man's burden as we understand it, which is not the same as master race. And then the second book is The Controversy of Black Nazis 2. And this is really addressing all these nutcase loonies who are on Amazon, etc., flipping out over this book. And it's an interview that is going to be featured in German, only parts of it, because they can only feature so much in Zuerst magazine, which is a German kind of quote-unquote right-wing magazine. And it's he's going under the pseudonym Ernest Young. So this is a German individual, and this is going to be in Zuerst in German. I have it in English, the whole entire thing expanded, so people can read that. And of course, I have Ethan B. Katz's review addressed in there.
You can't leave him out.
And also this Garrett Phillips, absolute imbecile, who's just insistent on coming after every one of my publications on this topic. I don't know who he is. I don't know what his beef is, but he's obviously a screwball.
But, and they won't address you,
absolutely
privately.
Not. And here's the cute thing about him. This Garrett Phillips of Islington, London, UK. And of course, it's an Englishman. It always is. His whole thing is, I bought her first book. Okay, and he did. But that book is the actual kosher master's thesis with direct references to Jewish genocide and Zyklon B use and gas chambers, as it was put to my thesis advisor so that it passed in 2009. It is not what he thinks, and his review does not reflect that in any way, shape, or form. He is inventing his review. And how do I know this? Because his review of the first release of Black Nazis, which is no longer available, it sold out. I only put out 200 copies of that book. The last copy I sold went for $300. So he's lying to you when he said that it was so awful it was pulled. No, it wasn't. That is an absolute lie. And I have the printed receipts as proof. I have his printed receipt as well. He bought the book on September 20th. His review posted on September 20th. One can go to the Black Nazis listing on Amazon.com and read that for themselves. I have the printed receipt proving the exact time of day and everything that he bought that book. He lives in London. I'm in America. He did not get that book in one day. I didn't even ship it until the 21st. So his review went up and was never changed the day he bought the book. Because what he did is he bought the book and then he looked me up on the internet. And then he went, oh, this is revisionist trash. No, it isn't. Whatever. Guilt by association in that case. He never did pull that review. I have written Amazon now about 8 times about that review. They will not pull it. They will not. In fact, they went after me. They're attacking
really?
Me. They've banned my accounts and everything. They're just totally creepy. Okay, so that's the first thing. Well, now Mr. Phillips has decided, oh, because she has a subsequent 2010 release, this is the Black Nazis 2 2010,
mm-hmm.
Herein all of his complaints are addressed. Every single thing he wrote in the comments section under his review on the first release of Black Nazis is addressed in Black Nazis 2. And there's now a third release of that. Okay, because I updated it again in the light of the new information and the new photos I was sent, including the Ken magazine article, etc. That is too important not to have in that book. That's why the third one was released. There's a lot of new stuff coming out, and I want it in there. So he puts this new slam review on not only the 2010 release, but the new 2012 release. The same exact filthy little review. This is all in the controversy of Black Nazis 2. I have his full shenanigans, what he put on there. And okay, so
that's funny.
And Amazon will not pull those down. I said, listen, these are different books. All three of these are different books.
Mm-hmm.
They're enough to be considered a different book. He admitted in one comment he posted, which is now a pulled review. The Amazon pulled it down as soon as I showed them what he had written. And that he had admitted that he not only didn't read Hitler's Jewish Soldiers by Brian Rigg, which he cites as though he read it in his slam review. He goes, you should consult this book. It tells the truth, unlike her. He's never even read it. So how does he know that? Okay, and Brian Rigg undercuts his own thesis basically with what he presents. So that's just bunk anyway. They pulled that review, but he says in that comment, I only have her first edition, but I'm reviewing this one anyway. I mean, this guy admits on the Amazon site, I don't have the book I reviewed twice with the same exact slam review. I showed that to them, all of it. They said his reviews are within guidelines and you no longer have privileges to even contact us.
Oh my goodness.
I guess I've irritated them too much.
Well, it's all these books you write that have all this truth. Gosh.
And now managing our perception of the Third Reich is slightly shorter. But it starts out, I mean, again, people can look at the very intro. It talks about how the NSDAP protected Africans. It gives you the actual text of the circular, the thesis that makes them scream Nazi apologist. If you say anything that the war served as a vehicle of change, it changed Nazi attitudes about other races, etc., you're some kind of Nazi apologist, fascist, and liar. So that's all in there. And of course, I have lots of great pictures in all of these that are very clear and look very nice in digital format. And one of them is the funeral of MK Ataturk. And there is literally this dark-skinned, I'm assuming he's Turkish, in full SS regalia with the NS armband and everything right there in the picture.
Indeed.
You know, I'm sorry, people, but the Nazis' rhetoric and what they actually did in practice are two different things. And if you can't see that, then you're blind. You are not looking. You need to open your eyes and look at what's actually there in front of you. And of course, Franz Wimmer Lomkvist's memoirs are in Swastika and Scimitar, and one can read about how he was prepared for years to go to Tanganyika. He had to be fluent in Kiswahili before he was even sent. And Heydrich and Hitler both supported him in his recruitment of Africans to agitate against the British there, the Britzies.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all in there. His whole story, his little episode he had starting, you know, using the special chemical to start the fire to get the passive resistance going that freaked out the Britzi occupation authorities. It's a wonderful memoir translated by Hans Kampa. It talks about it. The NSDAP in Africa with African support against.
Amazing.
And of course, Hans Massaqua, recently passed away, by the way, 87, grew up black in Nazi Germany.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing memoir. It undercuts so many lies. It's a must have. Everyone is saying it supports the Holocaust on the Amazon reviews. They don't understand what they're reading. They're blind. You don't grow up black in Nazi Germany and be a Holocaust victim. Sorry, but that totally undercuts that lie. But he really tells the truth about America, about racism generally against blacks everywhere, how the NSDAP was at least honest in the way it felt, that he was helped out by SS people, that he was treated respectfully by the SS man that interviewed him for his internship as a machinist. And also the fact that this SS man said, we're going to need people like you because when we get our colonies back, we're going to have these liaisons between Germany and Africa. And we need mulattoes and we need Afro-Germans there to be those liaisons, to make that connection and
have
to minister Africa. That's not indicative of either crass racism, ultra racism, extermination, or Hitler's going to come into Africa and obliterate the African race. It undercuts the whole thing. And when you put it all together, his memoirs with the Black Nazis thing, with Franz Wimmer Lomkvist's mission, et cetera, you've undone that thesis completely. But people like Garrett Phillips just can't. He can't handle it. And he goes on and on about all these books that I have. I own every single book he cited and have read them all. The Other Germans, Hitler's African Victims, Hitler's Black Victims. I have those. I've read them all. None of them are good arguments. Every one of them exonerate the NSDAP. It's inadvertent, but they do it. And I have proof in my book. I show you exactly where they do it again and again. And, you know, I'm sorry, but that's just, you know, that's just how it came out. I mean, this Raphael Scheck, I actually had email correspondence with him. He is a jutesy French author who wrote Hitler's African Victims. And he admits in that book that Hitler never ordered any kind of massacre or extermination or anything of any African POWs. That was a rumor. It was a myth. So I can't explain the title of his book.
Right. Well, oftentimes people just simply do not, well, oftentimes, most of the time people don't read. They read the reviews and then they assume that the person who wrote the review knows what he's talking about, when in fact that is not the case.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it's unfortunate.
Exactly. Yeah. One has to read the book. Because another thing is when you're depending on a reviewer, these reviewers are not always the sharpest tools in the kit. And they'd really, a lot of them, Garrett does not know what he's reading. He may read a book, but he doesn't comprehend. And yes, I'm going to pass that judgment on him. I will.
Well, the other thing you
really
have...
If he really read Black Nazis, the original release, then he doesn't know how to comprehend. He has no reading comprehension ability.
Or they work for somebody and they're paid to review books and give them a bad rap so that people will assume that, oh, this scholar has reviewed this and
exactly.
This is what he says. And I think that a lot of them, well, as you mentioned, a lot of them put up the reviews before they've even read the book or the day that the book is published.
Yeah.
How does a person
I can prove that he did that with mine.
Right.
And I can also prove that it wasn't pulled because it was so awful and such a joke.
Right.
No, it wasn't.
I mean, some of these academians who put out books, they have 25 reviews the day that the book comes out and think, how'd that happen?
You know, just on grapevine, let's say. yeah, and Ethan B. Katz, the fact that he reviewed my book, that tells me more than the review itself.
Mm-hmm.
Very concerned about that thesis. That's what it tells me. And any time Mr. Katz wants to debate, he'll get creamed. I can say that very... I'm not trying to be arrogant, but he will be creamed. Especially given that he's pro-Zionist. And I make this point in Black Nazis 2. In this day and age, for Israel to be the ethno-Jutsist racial apartheid state it is absolutely unbelievable. Back in Hitler's day, that was the prevailing order. And Hitler was even more lenient to the Jutsis than the Jutsis are to the Arabs in their own traditional homeland that the Jutsis invaded. Hitler was kinder and was more tolerant and did more for the Jutsis than they're doing for the Palestinians in this day and age. Back when that was the prevailing order, that should strike people as stunning.
Well, even the Jews in Poland, who were very persecuted in Poland for a number of, well, after World War I, clear through to World War II, they were persecuted. And many of them felt that they had a better chance living in Germany under Hitler than they did in Poland.
That's right. Yes, the Poles were extremely anti-Jutsist, and they had their reasons for being so. One other thing, I guess we could go over the whole Polish aggression against Germany. A lot of people still don't seem to grasp that Poland grabbed a piece of Czechoslovakia with no problem at all while they were in league with Hitler. And yet that somehow becomes irrelevant later on when Hitler wants what he's entitled to.
Right.
Poland. And then the second thing I would say about the Poles is, again, if the penchant to attack Germans in the way they did was not there before it actually happened on Bloody Sunday, if that wasn't there to begin with, it wouldn't have happened. That's really just it's not a forgivable crime. I mean, the way they killed those people is so horrendous. Hitler was absolutely justified to invade Poland. And then, of course, we have Polish aggression against Ukraine. I believe it was Lithuania.
Mm-hmm.
Well before World War II. And the Poles, of course, were deliberately given those pieces of Germany to cause the conditions that later emerged.
Right.
Britzies and French did that intentionally with the Versailles Dictate.
Sure.
They were set up to go head-to-head at some point. And then, of course, we do have... I believe it's Soviet sources, but, you know, in my view, certainly credible. and I can send you this, that Joseph Beck was a German agent or was far more pro-German than we would care to know, at least mainstream history. So the only reason the Poles turned on that alliance with Germany, which was well in the making, and in fact the Germans were bending over backwards to promote Polish culture, to celebrate, to commemorate the death of Joseph Piłsudski as a great man. They had an official funeral with the Polish flag featured in the center of the room and Hitler standing right next to it, right after his death, to commemorate his death. Goering visiting with Joseph Beck and his wife personally, with Hitler and Goebbels as well, on numerous occasions. The Poles were encouraged to unite, and I mean, Goering makes this point over and over, in an alliance against the Soviet Union. It makes sense. I mean, Poland, you're our natural ally.
Right.
That was all tainted by the Britzies and the French and their Jutsi antagonists.
Right.
Okay, so that does it really right there. For anyone that goes, Hitler was unjustified in attacking Poland, no. Poland allowed itself to be used as a tool of Britain and France.
Right. And they'd been making sorties into German territory several times, for several months.
Right. And, of course, the Gleiwitz thing is mentioned only in passing in one line of the entire White Book. The Gleiwitz incident that's put up there is Hitler's case, his actual cause for war. No.
Right.
So...
And that became big during the trial, Nuremberg trials, and they made a big deal out of it.
Right.
That's where it got legs right there.
Right. And I guess we can close on just kind of discussing the truth movement generally. I just need to say this, but I have noticed it seems to me that there is a neo-Nazi white nationalist, white racist movement infiltrating in there. Now, whether or not these are really Jews, I don't know. I know for a fact that I've had problems with these white nationalist types before. I am not a white nationalist. I do not support white nationalism. I'm not a neo-Nazi. I don't support that. That has absolutely nothing to do with NS Germany or National Socialism. And actually, most of these supposed white nationalists would never be pro-Hitler anyway because they seem to all flock to capitalism or be proponents of some kind of system like that, and individualism, and not the collective kind of prevailing over individual, which is more or less what Hitler had. He didn't completely negate the personality and the individual, but it was more or less about the collective and the state, that
right.
The individual served the state, not vice versa. Okay, so they really don't even understand why they support Hitler. They just think he was some white supremacist advocate. Now, Hitler very, very rarely used the term white race. I believe it's Weißesrasse in German. Very rarely. Only on a couple occasions. Now, the thing that he did use was this Nordic principle. And, of course, as I mentioned in the beginning... America was a meta-nation, whereas Hitler was trying to create a more or less ethno or folkish nation that would be serving of this people instead of many peoples being conglomerated into a Freemasonic empire such as that created in America, in America by the Masons. So it was kind of a reaction against that, a revolt against that metanational global Freemasonic agenda in play at the time. He was trying to stop that, at least in Europe, and maintain the true diversity of Europe, which is we're all separate states, but in separate ethnicities, etc. But there's going to be a Germanic administration. Germany's going to be the administration over all these races and peoples of Europe. That's all he was doing. It was no different than the federal Masonic government overseeing the states of the U.S. We still have a degree of sovereignty. Each state has its character, its folkishness, yet we're all united under the federal government. Okay, that's what Hitler was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And there were going to be some Slavic states included in that. And it's very clear from the Dahlen book that that was the case. So that's all it was going to be. And I don't think that the white nationalists really understand that. And also, Hitler was more or less anti-Slavic. He did not see them as equal to Germans. So this idea that he was going to somehow forge the white race into this global power, no, that's nowhere. There were going to be whites subordinated under this Germanic administration that weren't quite going to be on equal par with the Germans and other Europeans. Now, of course, Hitler always made exceptions. And if he had won the war, I think it's safe to say that the elation and especially goodwill of those who had been vanquished would have changed the attitudes a little bit, because it was already starting that way in 1944 and 45. Himmler was making concessions. You know, Rosenberg was saying, dude, give Ukraine independence. Okay, it's over. You know, so that was already headed that way. There were already many NSDAP members that were very pro-Slavic, and they saw all the different Russians as one unto each unto their own. They weren't all one gray Muscovy mass. So that's important to understand, that it's white races, not white race.
Right.
But I think that they're ruining the truth movement, these people, with
yes.
their racism and their horrible, vicious, mendacious comments they're leaving, especially on that grizzonblogspot.com. There are awful things said there. I don't want anything to do with that blog. I would rather they didn't post my interviews. And I'll let them know that. They need to know that. But mm-hmm. it's not against the maker of that blog. But if you're going to have a blog like that, you really do need to start moderating the comments. Because I'm personally disgusted by
right.
what's...
And they do them all under anonymous and say the most horrible things.
Yeah.
And nobody refutes it.
And they would never, ever say that to someone's face.
Of course
I
not.
Want you with your face and your name saying that to me, to my face.
Mm-hmm.
They would never do it. The internet is giving these anonymous entities a security blanket that they would never, ever act and say the things they do, act like they do and say the things they do on the internet if they didn't have that security blanket.
Oh, absolutely.
And it's detestable. And the things they've said about Carolyn Yeager, et cetera, who is a white advocate, that's even detestable. They're attacking
mm-hmm.
everybody and ripping the whole thing apart. And they, I would call them definitively racist, that there
mm-hmm.
is such thing as a racist and they're it. If you're going to make sweeping generalizations about how wonderful your race is and how horrible and degenerate another race is, that's racism to me.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean you have to be white guilt and this and that. One can be tolerant and accepting of other races and not feel guilty as a white person. You know, the two don't have to go hand in hand. So they assume that just because you're okay with other peoples, well, you must be one of those multicult people, or you're a diversity rainbow. You must have white guilt. It's your white guilt doing that. No, it isn't. It's a higher level of maturity.
Right.
They're very immature. So I just need to say that. And of course, one of my essays is posted on VNN, and I just want people to know that I am not a member of that and I don't support them. You know, they're simply cutting and pasting an essay from Inconvenient History onto there.
Oh, okay.
So people need to know that. Anyone can cut and paste essays and put them on any site they want. We must be careful not to assume that that person is affiliated with that site or that ideology.
Right.
And that's all I would say.
All
I mean,
right.
I don't know how you feel about it.
I feel pretty much the same. I mean, people have slammed me on the grizzonblogspot.com. I do appreciate him putting the programs up.
Right.
But some of the horrible things that are said are just outrageous.
In the language used.
Oh.
It reeks of a 16-year-old boy who's been recently broken up with his girlfriend.
Right.
Now he wants revenge. You know what I've noticed too? Very anti-female. It's all white women's fault. These themes are so destructive.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, definitely. Don't want to be affiliated with that. I just had to get that out there.
Yeah.
You know, so it's nice to have the ones. John Friend seems to be staying away from that. I hope he does. There are others who have succumbed and it has ruined their websites. I cannot send anyone to those sites because they're going to read that in the comments and the horrible language used and go, this is disgusting. You are not going to reach the mainstream. Oh. I'm going to tell you that right now. And that's the very people you need to reach.
Right.
You know, and that's that.
Yeah, profanity is commentary on the people that are using it, and it just lets people know that they don't have a good enough vocabulary to express themselves without using bad words.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well,
I don't know if there's anything else you want to touch on.
I think we need to have a program on some other topics, other issues that we've covered before, but that are just cropping up again, Mengele and eugenics and that kind of thing.
Okay.
So, anyway, we'll schedule something as your time permits.
All right. That sounds good. And it's been wonderful as always.
Oh, love chatting with you.
Yes, definitely. I enjoy your shows, and you're the only one I will go on any shows with. I've done a couple with other individuals that no more.
So well, thank you.
Yes.
Thank you. Well, I certainly consider it an honor to talk with you and certainly love your scholarship. It's wonderful.
Well, thank you very much. And I appreciate yours. And my brother's still reading your second book.
Good.
Slowly chewing through it. He works a lot, so he can only read so much, but he's being enlightened.
Good.
Yeah.
Well, they are lengthy and, you know, they're heavy and I should break them up more, but
it's great information, though.
Well, thank you.
Yes, you are very welcome.
All righty. We will talk again soon.
All right. You take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.